Thank you, I think, for that. Do you know that terrible story about this good morning business, about the abbot and the good morning, the monks? No, you don't know that? Well, every morning here at Holden, you get the good morning. You have to say good morning. Now we get the good evening. There's a story about the monastery where they had gone from Latin to English. And, you know, the abbot used to come in and say, Dominus vobiscum, and so on, and the monks would answer, chant. Well, they don't do that anymore. The abbot comes in the morning and he says, good morning. And all the monks chant back, good morning. It's really lovely. But one morning, one of the monks had been down in the cellar the night before, working the Xerox machine, I suppose. And so, in the morning, the abbot said, good morning. And the monk said, good morning. And then this voice said, good evening. And there was this dead silence. And the abbot drew himself up. The monks waited for the thunderbolt. And the abbot said, some monk chanted evening. Pretty bad. Right. Thank you. No, don't encourage him. Please don't encourage him. To purge your souls of such a bad pun. I want to, this has nothing to do with what I'm going to say, but I want to share it with you because I like it very much. And being here in the valley reminded me of a poem of E.E. Cummings that I like very much called I Am a Little Church. Now, I don't know how you feel about E.E. Cummings. I always had trouble with him because of his punctuation or lack thereof. So I never read him very much when I was growing up. But when I became older, it didn't matter anymore because I couldn't see the punctuation marks anyway. So I found this poem some years ago, and I liked it very well and copied it out on a sheet of paper, which I carried with me. And then I found this selection of Cummings poems here in the bookstore and bought it because it had some things in it I hadn't found, and it had this one. So I'm going to just read it to you as a little freebie this evening. I'm a little church, no great cathedral, far from the splendor and squalor of hurrying cities. I do not worry if briefer days grow briefest. I am not sorry when sun and rain make April. My life is the life of the reaper and the sower. My prayers are prayers of earth's own clumsily striving, finding and losing and laughing and crying children, whose any sadness or joy is my grief or my gladness. Around me surges a miracle of unceasing birth and glory and death and resurrection. Over my sleeping self float flaming symbols of hope, and I wake to a perfect patience of mountains. I am a little church, far from the frantic world with its rapture and anguish, at peace with nature. I do not worry if longer nights grow longest. I am not sorry when silence becomes singing winter by spring. I lift my diminutive spire to merciful him whose only now is forever. Standing erect in the deathless truth of his presence, welcoming humbly his light and proudly his darkness. Now this evening we're going to talk about ecumenism. And that's a big step forward because 15 years ago we couldn't even agree how to pronounce the word There were the people who call it ecumenism and those who call it ecumenism. Finally, we seem to have settled on one way of pronouncing it. And it is also now for us all in the Christian church, but in some senses, particularly for us Lutherans, an important frontier. Because we have been a bit late coming to the party, and it seems to me we have something significant to offer. It poses questions for us as Lutherans. What do we have to contribute to the larger Christian community? What will making that contribution require of us? Will it demand things and understandings that we are not prepared or aware of giving? Personally, I believe that we do have a unique contribution to make, and that in the process, we too will be changed, and I think for the better. Tonight, I want to explore that a bit with you, and I hope that I will be brief enough so that we can have some opportunity for dialogue or discussion if you wish. So at the end of the presentation, I will be willing to hear your reactions or opinions. First of all, I'd like to say something about the present ecumenical movement and our involvements in it, because they are many faceted, and sometimes we think of only one or two when actually there are quite a number. And we can start, of course, with a local ecumenical scene. Local ecumenism is the place where many of you meet it and perhaps participate. It can be as simple as a situation, a local community, where congregations get together for some specific purpose. It may be social action, it may be social concerns, it may be humanitarian activity or an emergency, something in which the churches band together, perhaps not regularly, but on an ad hoc basis to take care of some emergency or to meet some need. It may go beyond that, though. There may be a ministerial association which is more or less active in your community. Many times they are not very effective most of the time because they don't really have a cause or a project to work on. But now and then things come up, or now and then leadership is such that such activities can be really fruitful. Perhaps also you've participated in some joint inter-church project to make the church more available or prominent in the community, some advertising campaign, some joint services or other project in which a number of congregations become involved. Maybe you've been involved in some common Thanksgiving or other celebration where the churches in the community get together. And of course, those can be frustrating, but they can also occasionally be rewarding and satisfying when one of them goes right. And my only rule for ecumenical services is be sure you have it in writing. That is, if you're going to have a service, a joint service, be sure it's all written out. Because there's nothing worse, it seems to me, than going along with a service and everything going fine until you get to the Lord's Prayer, and half of them have got trespasses, and then a few have got debts, and then there are those who stop halfway through, and we're running on with kingdom and power and glory forever and ever, and everybody else is looking around waiting to what's come next. The same thing with creeds. You've got to watch that, because the Methodists don't always descend into hell with us and leave us waiting at that point. You sing hymns together, and you got to watch the hymnals. We were doing a service with Roman Catholics once, and we were singing Faith of Our Fathers. And they've got the original version, which has this whole big passage about a whole verse on Mary in it that the Lutherans found very embarrassing. They stopped singing and started humming, and then the Catholics started laughing, and it kind of destroyed the whole purpose of what we were trying to do together. So if you've had any experience that way, you know it's really important to observe proper etiquette at that point and try to get it in writing so that the service is all printed out and everybody knows what's going to be said when. Ecumenical service is also going to be lots of fun. Having just moved to Iowa, there are a lot of new customs we're getting used to, and one of the towns just north of us is Mabel, Minnesota. And Mabel has a thing called steam engine days. And that's not locomotives, but that's the old thrashing machine, steam engines, and they have quite a celebration there. And They wanted somebody from the college to come up and preach, and so I suggested to my assistant that it would be a good way for him to get to know the community. I was conveniently busy that Sunday, and I couldn't imagine going to something called Steam Engine Days and preaching in an outdoor service to the whole panoply. He came to the office one day and was quivering visibly, and he said, "I just discovered that I've got to preach in this open-air service, and there's all kinds of groups there, everybody from Quakers to Roman Catholics and local people and people, farmers coming in from the rural churches. What in the world am I gonna say? What can I preach on?" And all of a sudden, I said, "What was that again? Who's going to be there?" He said, "Everybody from the Quakers to the Roman Catholics." And I said, "That's great." I said, "What a wonderful opportunity. You could wait a lifetime to be able to begin a sermon and say, 'Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ear.'" I asked him if he dared to do it, and he said no, and I said, "Next year I'm going to go. I just..." It's just too good. Well, beyond the beyond possibilities for cooperation at the local level, there's obviously the national level, at which church bodies cooperate in many ways, but principally through councils of churches, National Council of Churches in the United States, Canadian Council of Churches in Canada, and then on the international level, a World Council of Churches as well. Now, participation in these groups is not always comfortable. In fact, it is downright difficult for us to participate. Any group in which democratic process rules means that if you are a participant in that group, you are sometimes subjected to decisions and processes with which you cannot easily agree. It has been the case in working with the National Council, for example, on some of their social statements, that the theological sections have been acutely embarrassing to Lutherans, and we have done our best sometimes to try to make contributions to change the wording or to alter the form of those statements. And sometimes we've been just plain outvoted and have had to put up with whatever came. But I would also say that sometimes we are put in judgment. It's not always so bad to be uncomfortable. For example, the predominance of black denominations in the National Council of Churches is, in some sense, a kind of healthy corrective to us. And it's not fun to hear yourself criticized as we've gotten criticized there. But on the other hand, we don't hear that from ourselves. We don't have the strength or the voice within our own black minorities in Lutheran traditions sometimes to give us the kind of sharp and well-meant but nevertheless penetrating judgment that we hear. It, of course, would be possible to stay out of these bodies, both nationally and internationally, and some Lutheran bodies have indeed taken that point of view. It provides the opportunity to preserve one's integrity and not get involved in such compromise and embarrassment. It also, however, can lead to a confrontation mode occasionally, to some misinformation, stereotyping, and duplication of efforts. It's not easy, but just because it's not easy or it's not clean, I don't think it's necessarily bad. I think that an incarnational approach can allow us to participate in such activities, knowing that the holiness of the church never, never has depended on us, but also always depends on God, and that therefore it is possible for us to take risks and in some cases find that our best thinking is not accepted in the light of the fact that God can use even human mistakes for his purposes, and that in some cases what we think is right may actually not be God's will at all. I'm willing to go that far and to dare that much and to say that we need to be a bit humble about our own participation and recognize that the truth is larger than we. Now, those are just some brief comments on the international and national Council of Churches scene. Constance Parvey, as you know, has participated and worked in the World Council for the last few years, and I'm hoping that tonight, at least at Fireside, maybe she will say something about her estimate of the World Council and its workings. I know we all hear so much about the social and political activities or quasi-political activities of these councils of churches. I'm sure you're all aware also that there are a great many other activities which they carry on within the churches and for the churches, which do not receive such publicity, but which have done and continue to do much good. I want to concentrate a little more fully, though, this evening on another aspect of ecumenical activity, and that is the bilateral dialogues, because that is something in which all the four church bodies represented in this room do participate, either through Lutheran World Ministries, that's the Lutheran Roman Catholic Dialogue, or through Lutheran Council in the USA, which is the dialogue with all the other groups. And I want just to mention the variety. We talked about from Quakers to Roman Catholics. Well, we are in dialogue, or have been in dialogue, with Eastern Orthodox, with Episcopalians, with persons of the Reformed tradition, with Baptists, with Methodists, and with conservative evangelicals. We have also investigated the possibility of dialogue with Pentecostal groups. But, and this is one of the problems that we get into when we try to dialogue with other traditions, the question is, who speaks for some of these groups? Now, we have within our tradition the Lutheran Council, and it can set up dialogues that involve the four Lutheran bodies that are here. But, for example, when we started working with the Baptists, who represents the Baptists? If you don't get every Baptist in one room, you'll never know what the Baptists teach, because one of their tenets is that nobody can speak for the Baptist churches, and that therefore the dialogue that's being carried on with the Baptists has representatives from Southern Baptist Convention, American Baptist Convention, General Baptist, and so on. But even so, not all are represented. The same thing was true with the Orthodox. We no longer are dialoguing with the Orthodox because we found it impossible to find a group with which we could collect representatives of the various Orthodox traditions for a second round of dialogues. They are currently in a process of internecine warfare. And I'm sorry. Now, the conservative evangelicals were again a problem, because here you have everything from the National Association of Evangelicals through to a vast number of independent groups of one sort and another. And finally, the decision here was to go with some theological faculties. The faculties of certain conservative evangelical schools were consulted, and they worked out a series of conferences faculty to faculty rather than do the usual dialogue format. So we have essentially tried to work with every group that we could locate where there was a faith community, such as the Episcopal Church or the North American Alliance of Churches holding the Reformed tradition, and worked with those persons to work out a dialogue team and format. Well, now, what happens at dialogues, what we talk about, tends to vary with the group that we work with. The Roman Catholics and the Reformed, we talk doctrine. They are sort of our kind of people when it comes to wanting to talk theology in stated categories. But with the Orthodox, for example, with the Episcopalians, with the Methodists, we had to hold a much wider kind of inclusive discussion, which dealt with the ethos, the lifestyle, the tradition of the church body. They were not so willing to focus only on doctrines, but wanted to discuss the whole way of living and way of worshiping within those traditions. Well, that was very exciting and good for Lutherans, because it helped us to recall and remember that the life of the congregation, the life of the church, is broader than simply a list of doctrines written down on a page. With the Baptists, we really had a problem, because they were very skittish of getting into dialogue at all. They felt that the word would get back to their people, that they were in dialogue with the Lutherans, and their people would begin to think that some kind of merger was about to take place. And so they asked that a contract be worked out ahead of time. that would indicate exactly what the goal of the process was and what would happen. And two things they said. One was, the goal for us is not going to be any kind of closer cooperation or relationship, but only the removal of false stereotypes. They simply wanted to work toward understanding. The second thing they said was, no common statement. We're not going to try to draft anything that would remotely resemble some kind of platform that would, on the one hand, try to represent all Baptists, or on the other hand, try to indicate that we were now agreeing with the Lutherans on something. Well, that was funny, because that indicates the skittishness with which that tradition entered into relationship with us. The irony of the situation was that once they got down and started talking, it became extremely interesting to them, and there have been some very fruitful discussions on things like the sacraments, on questions of church order, on the question of the authority of creeds, which, as you know, Baptists tend to be rather cautious about. And in all these ways, we have discovered much common ground and interest, and they have learned a lot about us that they never learned from their textbooks. I want to say a word about what goes on in dialogues, because I'm sure some of you are aware of this, but a lot of people just hear we do it and don't quite know how the process operates. Now, of course, a dialogue is not like what Neil Simon writes, not nearly that scintillating and sharp. It's not even conversation. I talked to somebody once about this, and he said, well, I think a dialogue, you probably sit down and say, well, Charlie, what do you believe about justification by grace? And Charlie says, well, you know, we've thought about that in our church for a long time. We don't really think much of justification by grace. And, oh, well, what do you, and so on, back and forth. Well, there's very little of that kind of free floating conversation. The dialogues focus basically on papers which are presented. Lutheran Roman Catholic dialogue, for example, we're now dealing with the question of justification. So, first you have papers on the biblical doctrine of justification. Of course, we discovered that Pauline material would be quite different from what you would discover in the pastoral epistles or in James, for example. So we had to have separate papers on that. And the fascinating thing there was that most of the papers were done by a Lutheran and then commentary by a Roman Catholic scripture scholar. And after the presentation of those early papers, we discovered a vast amount of agreement about what Scripture says on justification. It was somewhat shocking to the Lutherans when the response to the Lutheran paper came back, and the Catholic theologians said, basically, I find no problems with anything that Dr. Ruman has written in this paper. But then he had a few minor questions about interpretation of individual texts. We move from Scripture, though, then to the question of what the traditions of each church had been. Justification in the Augsburg Confession, and then in the Apology. The Council of Trent on justification, Vatican II on justification, the Helsinki Convention of the Lutheran World Federation and its wrestling with justification. All those become parts then of the mosaic. And ultimately, after a paper is read and there's been some response, there is usually discussion, page by page, of what the author meant and said. Then there's a caucus, usually. The caucus is not for Catholics to think up the ultimate bomb question to lay on the Lutherans, or for Lutherans to develop the perfect description of justification so we can simply give it to Catholics and say, you know, will you sign? But rather, it's an effort to pull together, after hearing a paper, say on the Council of Trent, what are the major issues that we need to focus on here? What are the questions now that we've got to check out with the conversation partners? And then, that after the caucus, the questions are put to the other team, and they make their answers. And it's really fun, because the Roman Catholic team, for example, has persons on it like Avery Dulles, Jesuit, and a very able theologian, and Carl Peter, who is the dean of the Catholic School of Theology at Georgetown, and at Catholic University in Georgetown, and he's a very conservative individual who can quote the Council of Trent more often than one would care to hear it. He can bring it in almost any conversation. It's really clever how he can bring the Council of Trent into almost any conversation. And then there's George Tivard. I don't know whether you've ever heard of this Frenchman, George Tivard, or not. He teaches at the Methodist School of Theology in Ohio. And he had not been terribly well acquainted with Luther on justification. So as the dialogues began, he went out and bought Luther's commentary on Galatians and read that and came back and he said, I have read Galatians and I think Luther is absolutely correct. And from then on, every once in a while when things would get really difficult, Tivard will say, well, Luther was right after all, you know, and everybody kind of shivers on the Catholic side. They say, George, let's have a caucus. We want to talk to you a little bit. But as it stands now, the third or the next stage after the caucus and questions is to draft a statement, to try to come to some common statement. And the one we're working on now for justification has as its concluding section something which we're calling simply a kind of summary or a statement. It's a very beautifully stated position on justification. It was written by George Tivard. It was written 2 years ago at the very beginning of our conversations as a summary of what he understood Luther to be saying and what he believed was also correct Catholic doctrine. In other words, he said that there was, as the way Luther described it, was, as far as he understood, what the Catholic Church also teaches or could teach if it was true to its tradition. So we're now in the process of drafting a statement. That's always the painful, long one. A drafting committee set up. Many of you remember Warren Quanbeck in the American Lutheran Church. He was one of the key drafters of many documents. He was an expert at that. He could listen and put down clearly and carefully what the positions were. We miss Warren very much because of his ability to do that for us. But the end result then is usually a statement, sometimes a common statement. Occasionally a statement with two parts, where Lutherans have to say certain things about the problem or position to Lutherans, and Catholics do that to their side as well, and then usually some common conclusion. We are presently on the draft stage, but one of the problems in the statement on justification has been that there has not yet occurred what has typically been called the breakthrough point. It seems that in the life of these dialogues, as topic after topic has been considered, work has been done on the final statement, usually there's come a point, a kind of aha experience, where people suddenly say, well, look, if we see it this way, we can find a way in which we can state the truth in a way that will be consonant with the traditions that we're working through. We have not come to that breakthrough point yet, although we may be getting there. The problem in the justification discussion is an interesting one. It is not on the question of whether God justifies us or whether we justify ourselves. There's not a Catholic in the room that believes that salvation is a human product, that we build a ladder up to heaven. No one says that. No one ever said it. They all believe that salvation is a gift of God's grace, but they then speak about grace, of course, enabling human beings to do things in response to the initial approach of God in justification, what we would term the process of sanctification, perhaps. But the problem in the Lutheran-Catholic dialogue on justification has been the fact that Lutherans make so much of justification, that it is essentially the gospel, the norm, by which all other doctrines are judged. The reason that justification has not been considered up to this time, after over 17 years of discussion, was that back early on, they thought there's no real doctrinal difference on this question. But as the debates went on other questions, like the ministry, the Eucharist, the papal infallibility, papal primacy, the Lutherans kept talking about the gospel all the time and judging this by the gospel. The papacy has to be reformed and obedient to the gospel. So the Catholics began to say, what in the world are you talking about here? You know, gospel, that comes at the beginning of the New Testament. There are four of them. Oh, no, he said, you don't understand, you know. And so then we have to give them our shorthand for what, that it really is speaking about God's forgiving the sinner by grace. Oh, well, now Lutherans say that is a sort of normative doctrine. Catholics say, well, that doesn't fit our system because we have what is called the hierarchy of truths. And we have various doctrines, and they're in various levels. And the highest doctrines are doctrines of God, the doctrine of the Trinity, for example. You're not saying that justification is a higher doctrine than the doctrine of the Trinity. No, we say we're not going on a pyramid like that. We're talking about a doctrine by which teaching in the church is judged. Oh, well, now we don't know. That sounds like papal magisterium to us. So we begin to fiddle around. And we've been arguing about this question, is how the Lutheran understanding of the primacy of the forgiveness of the sinner can be maintained and included in a statement. Well, maybe we've come to the breakthrough point. We've stopped calling it now a norm and are talking about it as an underlying principle. Well, you know, Lutherans have never talked about it as an underlying principle before. We always talk about it as a criterion, a norm. But there is a sense in which you can see it as a principle that underlies the way we approach and teach, and out of which all of our other doctrinal concerns spring to one degree or another. Well, Catholics can say that, okay, underlying principle, that doesn't put it in the hierarchy of truths. So we're currently working on a section of the statement called an underlying principle. And if the statement ever comes out, it's really that justification is norm, which is now called something else. It may sound like playing with words, but of course it's also a serious question to Lutherans whether a norm and an underlying principle are the same thing, or whether we've given up something precious in so doing. And so the debate goes on. We're still exploring. Well, why all this talk? Why in the world do we go through all this? What are we up to? What is the purpose of this kind of discussion? The dialogues have had several purposes. One of them, as I've indicated with the Baptists, was simply to understand each other better, to understand our true positions today, and not to fight straw men from the 16th or 17th centuries. For the Roman Catholics, the goal has been, though, as I've said, a common statement, the ability to see whether the old doctrinal formulations and the old shibboleths are still necessary, or whether there are other ways of saying the same thing. You might put it in an analogy. If you think about you and your husband or you and your wife going out to the yard, maybe you've done this once or twice, walking around, talking about what you need in the garden, or how you're going to change the plants. You suddenly discover that your wife never liked that cactus that you thought she liked very much and never dared criticize and never dared mention moving before. She suddenly says, well, if you didn't like that cactus, we could throw it out. And you say, me? I thought it was you who liked the cactus. And discover that, in fact, neither of you really care much for that plant anymore. But that blue spruce over there that's grown up and sort of blocked the view, you discover, as far as she's concerned, that's a non-negotiable. She likes it. She wants it to stay there. Gradually, as you walk around together and talk things over, you begin to find out that there are certain plants that are very precious to each of you. So you agree that you're not going to move them. You're not going to try to cut them down. You're going to have to live with them for a while longer. But you also discover where you can clear away some dead wood, or maybe pull up some things that neither of you have found very attractive or very productive. And maybe, in fact, you can agree that here or there you could plant a peace rose or something like that. Well, that's kind of the sort of preliminary survey that's been going on across the whole field of church doctrine and practice for the last 17 years with the Roman Catholics. But why? What's ahead? Why do we do this? Are we going to be swallowed up by the papacy? Are all these talks going to lead to foolhardy concessions to the Roman monster? Are we walking into a trap? Well, there are always folks who fear the worst and who think that's the primrose path down which we're going. A couple years ago, an issue of the Lutheran had on the cover, it was an article by Paul Empey, who was then the Lutheran chairman of the dialogue team, had on the cover a drawing to talk about Lutheran-Catholic discussions. And in order to show there had been some convergence, they had two pedestals. And they had a bust of Luther on one and of John Paul II on the other. And the pedestals, in order to demonstrate convergence, were slightly tilted toward each other with the busts on top of them. And so there was a kind of feeling that they were going to come together in some way. Well, the editor of the Lutheran told me that he got lots of mail on that cover. And several people had taken out their protractors and had measured the angle of the tilt of the two pedestals and discovered that Luther's was leaning farther than the Pope's and knew that this was the beginning of the end. Well, now, in reality, nobody, and I say this in absolute confidence, on either side, the Lutheran Roman Catholic dialogue is talking about reunion. In fact, Roman Catholic leaders expressed some worry a couple of years ago that memorials that were coming up in some of the Lutheran bodies about pushing toward certain new relationships with Roman Catholics were premature. They were very worried that such things would create problems because the Catholics would have to reject the possibilities and that might set things back. They don't want any kind of unilateral move that would push for some dramatic change. What they are hoping for and suggesting is simply that carefully, one by one, the doctrinal concerns that have long separated Lutherans and Romans would be looked at, would be studied, and we would find out exactly where the problems still remain. They believe that there are still problems, notably, of course, those connected with church governance, with the papacy, with apostolic succession, and so on. Some progress has been made, but not enough to change in any appreciable way the official position of the two churches. When we have our worship services on Sunday morning, the dialogues start usually on Thursday and go through Sunday noon. Catholics worship, still have their Eucharist by themselves, Lutherans by themselves. We work all week, we pray together at the beginning of each session, we study God's Word and all that, but when it comes to Eucharist or communion, we still go our separate ways to remind ourselves of the fact that we are not yet able to agree on some of the principles of the faith. Now, people have been upset by that fact that intercommunion is not possible, and I want to say a little more about that by suggesting that, at least on one front, that situation is also changing. That has to do, of course, with the relation between Lutherans and Episcopalians. Out of the Lutheran Episcopalian dialogue now has come, in fact, a substantial change in our relationships. The dialogue suggested that it seemed that there was sufficient agreement on our understanding of the presence of Christ and the Lord's Supper and the meaning of the Lord's Supper within both traditions so that it would be possible to celebrate communion together. But the way that is set up is still carefully guarded and represents visibly the fact that we are not yet agreed on all points. It is not intercommunion. It is not altar fellowship. It is called, and very carefully so, interim Eucharistic hospitality. Interim, meaning that although there are still things to be worked out, a sufficient basis of agreement has been reached so that Episcopalians are willing, from their side, to share in Eucharistic celebrations with Lutherans. And some Lutherans have said, we are willing from our side to share with you. But it's not intercommunion. This is where this neat little business about ecumenical etiquette again comes into play. First, local conditions must make it suitable. That means that there has to be some connection, some worship connection, and some fellowship already existing between the churches that are going to proceed with this Eucharistic hospitality. That doesn't mean that you've been worshiping each other's churches lately or having joint worship services of one sort or another, but it does mean that there is contact and communication so that matters can be worked out between the two church groups, whether they are congregations or whether they're a synod and a diocese. Secondly, they want to make sure that the words of institution or the Eucharistic prayer is either that in the Book of Common Prayer or that in the Lutheran Book of Worship. No free throws here. No, let's make up something appropriate for, National Donut Week or something like that. It's got to be the texts which are approved by the church bodies. And we've looked at theirs, and they've looked at ours, and they say, that's okay. The third thing, and this is the crucial thing, because it's at this point where there's still division and discussion. When clergy of the two communions are celebrating, they are both to be at the altar. And what essentially is happening in the Episcopal position is that the Episcopal priest is offering communion to the Episcopal parishioners and the Lutheran clergyman to the Lutheran parishioners. Of course, Lutherans can receive from either one, and there's no problem there, Episcopalians from either one. But it's necessary for Episcopalians and their concept of church order to have a person canonically ordained present at the altar and officiating in their sense for the Eucharist. That's why there have to be two clergy present from each tradition. It's a very interesting arrangement that's indeed interim, and it's hospitality. It's not yet intercommunion. We are welcome at their altars, they are welcome at ours, but in joint services it's necessary to have two clergy present. And full intercommunion, automatic intercommunion, is not yet available. Now, this is a new strategy for us Lutherans. As I've said, formerly we believed that full doctrinal agreement was necessary. That's the way it is with the Roman Catholics. That's why we don't celebrate Mass with them, or they don't come to our communion services. But Lutherans, remember, have always said that church government, the form of church government, is not of the essence. That church government may vary and differ, so if they have a bishop who's been ordained by another bishop and so on, that's fine. That's their way of doing it. That's what the Church of Sweden has. So it doesn't matter to us. That's okay. For the Episcopalians, that question of church order is still a difficult one for them to come to terms with as far as our tradition is concerned. But the Episcopalians believe that sharing the Eucharist will promote unity. Their view is that you don't wait until you get everything settled before you meet at the Lord's table, but that, in fact, Eucharist is a way in which unity will be promoted. The sharing of the one cup and the one bread will lead, then, they believe, to further doctrinal sharing and unity. So they're willing to do it because they believe that the Eucharist is a means to the goal. We're willing to do it because we say the chief, the critical thing, the agreement in the gospel has been reached, and the question of church order is something that should not be raised to the point of an ultimate doctrine. And so we have come to this interesting pass where we've now made it possible to have interim Eucharistic hospitality, and two of our church bodies have accepted that relationship. Well, that has perhaps been too lengthy and too long a discussion on this question, but I wanted to say something about that dialogue process. I now want to speak briefly to the question, what do Lutherans have to contribute to the ecumenical vision and the ecumenical scene? I think that Dr. Parvi said very, very well something that we should start from. That it's a tendency, an all-too-human tendency, to define ourselves by how we are different from others, that we are the non-something or others. They have some difference from us, and therefore we define ourselves by how we are different. Lutherans have done that for a long time. Lutherans are poorer than Episcopalians, are richer than Jehovah's Witnesses, have more fun than Mormons, and make better coffee than anybody else. You know, that kind of sort of rough estimate of where Lutherans fit into things. And we do it particularly in worship. In fact, I would say that for most people, worship has become the chief characteristic of Lutheranism. That is, how do most people distinguish Lutherans from others? Well, we use Bach more in our services, or we have a liturgy of a certain type, or we stand at certain places and sit at others while other people do it the opposite way, or we kneel and they don't, or you know, all of that sort of worship difference becomes very important because that's the way most people distinguish denominations.